Thank you, Bonnie.
I'd like to thank Jerry for calling me several years ago and inviting me to come this weekend. And I'd like to thank Bonnie. She's been just right there. She called me here a while back and told me she was going to be hosting me and made me welcome even before I got here. And it's always good to come back into this area. I have so many friends I've made over the years here and new friends. And I just thank you so much for the hospitality that I always find when I come in this area of the South. I just love it. Thank you very much. My name is Mary Pearl, and I'm an Al-Anon who is happy, joyous, and free. I'm sorry if you've come here to hear a suffering Al-Anon today. The reason I say that, I went to speak one time and heard a couple of ladies sitting at the table, and they said, they've got an Al-Anon speaker. God, a suffering Al-Anon. And so I told them when I got up, I said, if y'all would like to leave now before I start to suffer, y'all feel free. Don't want to put you out none. How dare an alcoholic say that we suffer? Of course we suffer. We live with y'all. We made an error in judgment. Probably the biggest one of a lifetime, you know. And given the opportunity, we'll do it again and again and again. And you know why? Right here. Because we love alcoholics. And aren't you glad? Because if it hadn't have been for some of us suffering Al-Anons, a lot of you drunks wouldn't have made it here. You'd have been dead and under the ground. Never forget that. And J.D. says to me, and never forget that if it wasn't for me, you wouldn't be where you are. We're both crazy. I think that's the reason it works so well, you know. The sickness in me called to the sickness in him, and vice versa. We seem to have this. You know, I was the youngest of four children, and I was a change-of-life baby, which meant that I was there's a great age difference between me and my siblings, 16 years between me and the closest one, 20 and 25 years difference. So I was an only child in a family of four. Well, I was always an only child because it's always just about me. You know, I had that as that lack of maturity, I believe it talks about in the book, seems to be a problem, you know, and little children always want their way, and I just never quite got over that, you know. I had a daddy who was retired. He was a 38-year military officer in the Army, and he retired to fish and hunt, and I was born a year or so later. And daddy was 54, and mother was 41. And so I was born in this home of old people. And they had already raised the kids and everything, you know. And my mama was a product of an alcoholic home. Her mother, father, two brothers, and two sisters were all drunks. My mother was the only one who did not drink alcohol. Frankly, I think she needed a drink. She was the most uptight bitch you have ever been around in your whole life. She couldn't have any fun and wasn't going to let you have any either. We weren't going to get along. My daddy, on the other hand, he was sort of laid back. I always wanted to ask daddy, but you know, when you're a little bitty kid, you have all these thoughts, but you don't know how to put them together to ask, and you don't know how to put it together to tell what you're just feeling and whatever, but it was like, why did you pick her? And my daddy had the audacity to die when I was 12, and I never figured that out until after my mother died. And I was going back through some albums there at the house. My mother was an absolutely gorgeous, gorgeous young woman. She was a beautiful woman, and I could see that he would have been attracted to her beauty. And it's like, how did she get so from that to that? You know, it's like, whoa. Anyway, Mama did not know how to have fun. She wasn't going to let you have any either, and so I gravitated toward Daddy. Now, my daddy retired to fish and hunt, and we raised English setter bird dogs and trained them. And so I went with Daddy fishing and hunting all the time. I was the tomboy, and I wanted to be a boy. Boys had more freedoms than girls did back in my day. And so I enjoyed that. And I enjoyed being around my daddy, and I just worshiped my daddy. Of course, my daddy spoiled me rotten, and I would love anybody who spoiled me rotten because I'm self-centered. And so anyway, I learned a lot with my daddy. When we would go out on that river and we'd get in that boat and go out there and we would talk, and I'm a person of a million questions. You see, I always want to know why about everything, because if I can figure out how everything works, then I can put that together and I know how to manipulate to get the hell I want out of life. If I know how you think and how you act, then I've got a key. And I didn't realize I started that very, very young. Well, I was 5 years old, and Mama decided one day she'd ruin our trip. She came with us. Now, Mama had rules. Mama had rules about everything. And she had rules about fishing, and it means she gets to catch the first fish, the biggest fish, and the most fish. Other than that, you can fish. Well, I screwed up. I caught the first fish. Well, it was a little old fish about like this, and Mama looked at it and said, "It's not a keeper," ripped it off my hook and threw it back. That was my fish. Now, I don't know about you, but I'm 5 years old, and, you know, my philosophy of fishing then and now, if it has eyes and a tail, string it. And Daddy, I just went in this screaming coma. And so Daddy told me, he said, "Honey, come back here at the back end of the boat with me." And as I got close to Mama, he leaned down and he said, "We'll get her." I didn't know what it meant, but intuitively, I knew I was going to like it. And what it meant was every time that she'd catch a fish, she'd swing it around, he'd take it off her hook, rebait her hook, and she'd go back to fishing, he'd give me the fish. I'd throw it over. Every fish the old heifer caught, I threw over. Now, when we got home that day, she was not a happy camper when we got home and had no fish. But what I learned that day, Daddy was playing a joke on Mama, and he was playing with me. That's not what I learned that day. What I learned that day was, if somebody does something and it hurts you, do it to them back as many times as you can. I learned revenge. And see, I didn't know that until I was doing a four-step inventory, and I'm writing all this down. I was writing that down as one of my most pleasant childhood memories. Well, like I say, 1954, I'm 12 years old, and my mama woke me up in the middle of the night, and she said, "Something's wrong with your daddy," and I ran, and I called an ambulance, and I ran into the bedroom and watched my daddy die of a heart attack. And my world as I knew it ended right there, because I was left with someone I didn't like, and I knew the main reason I didn't like Mama was I knew Mama didn't love me. Mama never told me she loved me. She always found fault with everything I did, everything I said, any thought I'd have, or even before I'd think it, she was already telling me I couldn't do it. And, you know, I just knew my mama didn't love me. And now there's something, I heard an expression, the face only a mother could love. And I'm thinking, that means a mother can love the ugliest kid in the whole world. What is wrong with me that my mama can't love me? What is wrong with me? And so I got mad. I got real mad. And I got mad at God. Now, I had been going to church with my family all these years, and I went, and I loved church, I loved Sunday school, and I loved everything about God is love, God is love, Jesus loves you. And I went, "Not me." Because, you see, that's a bunch of crap. If Jesus had loved me, he would have taken her and left my daddy. And so right then and there in my 12-year-old mind, I turn off on any kind of spiritual guidance from that point forward. It's all a lie. Now, does that mean I didn't go to church and Sunday school? No, it didn't. It just meant I wasn't buying the deal anymore. I knew it was all a lie. And so now we're into what is known as self-will run riot, I believe it's called. And but see, I'm the kind of kid, I am the kind of kid that has to make an A+ to feel equal to a kid who makes a C. I'm the overachiever. I'm the straight A+ student, you know. I'm the class valedictorian. I have to do all of those things so that I feel good about me, because I don't feel as good as other people. Because, see, there's something wrong with me. Don't you know, even my mother can't love me? There's something wrong with me. And it's those taking those things in, you know, when you're little like that, not knowing what to do with them, not dealing with them. Well, I know today that I needed some outside help when I was a kid. But you didn't send kids to shrinks in those days, and the term counselor hadn't even been born, I don't think. And so anyway, I go along. Well, then, you know, life has a way of making things different. And see, my thing, if I have a drug of choice, my drug is adrenaline. I'm addicted to excitement. And if I don't have some, I create some. You know, it's just that simple. I'll do whatever I need to for my addiction. And the world was helping me. They built an Air Force base in Little Rock. There was an item in the paper that said there were 10 men for every woman in the Little Rock area. I want my 10. And I want your 10 and your 10. Because, see, you know, there's never too much of a good thing. If it feels good, do it till you die on the spot. I mean, I just want to, I'm sort of like old Clint out in California. I just want to have fun. When he says that, I go, yes, that just gives me cold chills. I love it. I love it. So I went out to the base and went trolling. Now, there was this little old Yankee boy. He never knew what hit him. Because, see, my whole object in life at this point is to get away from home and her. And so I'm going to do what I need to do to get away from her. And that is, I'm going to get married. So I don't, and see, he's in the military, so we will go someplace exciting. We will go to France. We will go to Germany. We will go to Spain. We went to Newfoundland. It wasn't on my list. You know? And if you've, is there anybody here that's been to Newfoundland? Just one? Okay, you know what I'm talking about, don't you? You know, it was a land God forgot. I mean, we had snow 9 months of the year. Average snowfall, 200 inches of snow a year. You know, what's the big excitement in Newfoundland, you know? Well, there's a moose in the backyard. Woo. The worst thing about Newfoundland, it's boring, for God's sake. And see, boring, I don't deal with boring well, so now I have to create excitement, you know? So there was this, it was getting around Christmas time, and so I always felt like, see, I'm an avid reader, and I always thought, like, everything you ever need to know about life, you will find within the pages of a book. Little did I know it was going to have BB on it, you know, big book. But I didn't have one, you know. I didn't have Life 101, and that's what I feel the program of Al-Anon and Alcoholics Anonymous now teen is. It's the Living 101. It's a way to live successfully, living life on life's terms. But anyway, I didn't have that, but I had read about all these wonderful Christmases where people go out and cut down a tree, bring it in, decorate it, and have this wonderful feeling of love in Christmas. I want that. Well, you know, I was from Arkansas. We didn't have Christmas tree farms and stuff like that, so you had to go down to the local Sartoma or Optimist Club lot and buy one, bring it home, you know, try to get it stabilized and all this mess. And so I said, you know, I want this experience. Well, I lived in an apartment building. There were three apartments. My landlady lived in the middle, and I lived on this end. And she had two sons. They were like 14 and 16. And they had a toboggan. Now, I know everything about toboggans and sleds. I'm from Arkansas. Never had seen one before. But I figured out that if we went up this mountain, see, that our street was called Hillview. That's because we had this street. You had about 18 to 20 steps cut in the ice. And then you had the street, because you never were able to get your car out if you parked it down. And then on the other side of the street was this mountain. And I thought, well, we can go up the mountain and we can cut down one of these Christmas trees. Because, see, I'm in the land of Christmas trees. There are no leaves on a tree in Newfoundland. It's all needles, no leaves. And I said, we can cut down a tree, we can tie it to the toboggan, we can bring it down, we can make popcorn and cranberry garland, and, you know, we can just have fun. So I got my husband and the two kids next door and the toboggan and we saw, and up we go the hill. Well, there's something happens when you cut down the Christmas tree. It didn't look as good now laying down as it did standing up, because that one looks better. And you got to have the perfect experience here. And so we cut down several trees, and then it occurred to me that what we really needed was the top of a big tree. It's perfect. The top of a big tree is perfect. So we cut all this down. Now I've littered the mountain here. And so I decided that I would take all these Christmas trees back down to everybody in our apartment complex who had not asked me to do this. And so we tied them all on the toboggan, and then it occurred to me, wouldn't it be fun if we rode down on top of the trees? Now, today, I look at that and I'm like, what was wrong with me? But, you know, I'm a wealth of idiots that will follow directions. I mean, Because see, I learned early on, if you act like you know what you're doing, you will confuse a lot of people. You don't have to know what you're doing. Just look like it. And say, always come at it like, man, I got this, you know. And so here we are. We're all on the toboggan getting ready to go down the hill. And I had some leftover rope, and I'll tie me on the front because I don't want to fall off. Not a good move. Now, going downhill, I get a lot of information, but I can't do a darn thing with it. Going downhill, you're going to gain lots of speed. There are no brakes on a toboggan. There's no steering mechanism on a toboggan. You're just on for the ride. And we're coming down, and we go over some of the smaller trees. You know, they got thrown off. Not me, I'm tied on. I'm coming on that road, and there's cars going back and forth on the road. You know, I shot between the cars, went bip, 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 down those ice steps, shot right, and knocked a hole in the bottom of my house. The landlady comes out. She doesn't know if it's been a plane land on the house. Or, I mean, you know, a missile hitting the side of the house big enough to knock a hole in it. And I'm laying there, and I'm hurt. I have needles driven into my flesh. And she looks down at me and she says, what are you after doing, you crazy Yankee bitch? And I looked up at her and I said, don't call me a Yankee. Well, like I say, all that snow and everything, it was boring up there. But where I found excitement was going to be in the nightclubs. I love to go to the NCO club, the Airman's club, any club, because I begin to associate the sound of having fun with the sound of ice going in a glass. And that little sound when you pour liquid over the ice and you'd hear people laugh and they were having fun. And that's what I began to associate. Now, my mother had told me, don't ever drink. You know, we carry the bad seed. Where do you want me to put it? Well, see, mother telling me not to do something makes it very appealing to do it, you know. And so anyway, daily drinking became a way of life for me. And I drank an awful lot for a long time. I seemed to have a really good capacity for alcohol or bad, whichever way you want to go at it. But it wasn't that alcohol did anything for me. And it's my opinion, if it doesn't do anything to me, it's not do anything for me, it won't do anything to me because it's not a big deal. It was a social lubricant. It's what everybody did in order to have a good time. Now, my husband, he plays in the band in these clubs. And so I'm there, and while he's playing in the band, I'm drinking and trolling the room. I had a memory problem. I would forget from time to time that I was married. Because don't you know forbidden fruit is more exciting than what you have? I mean, that's just, can I say? And I worked for the Red Cross while I was there, and I had a black market on the flight line. I love to always push the envelope and be just doing little things just a little bit over the edge, because that fed that adrenaline need within me. And then we were there for 5 years, and they were going to close the base, and they were giving out assignments. And so I was talking to the guy in the SAC assignment section, and I said, where are we supposed to be going? And he said, well, let me look. And he said, well, your husband, y'all are going to go to Minot, North Dakota. What? Minot? I'm not. No, no, no. I've been in ice and snow 5 years. And he said, well, where do you want to go? And I said, I want to go back to Little Rock Air Force Base. Don't you know it's going to be all different back there now? You see, I didn't know that everywhere I went, there I was. I had no idea that I was a common denominator of what was going on in my life. You know, I'm a victim. It's always what you did or didn't do. You know, I always point, if you'd have followed the directions, this wouldn't have happened to me. You know, those kind of things. And so he said, well, there's not an opening in your husband's career field. My husband was an aircraft mechanic. And I said, well, that's pretty simple. Then change his career field. He said, oh, I can do that. And with a stroke of a pen, my husband, who was the aircraft mechanic, overnight became the head of a missile inspection team. He had never seen a missile. And off we went back to Arkansas. And you know what? It didn't work up there in Newfoundland. Guess what? It don't work here in Arkansas. But I wasn't ready yet to be self-supporting through my own voluntary contributions. So what I did was I convinced him that he needed to go on to the next base. When they got straightened out, they were going to change and move him to another base, and I would stay here. What it amounted to was I didn't ever want to be with him anymore, but I didn't want to give up the financial security that I had. And so that's that fast talking for a little slow thinking on the other side, you know. And so he went, and I was there, and now I'm free. You know, I had her telling me what to do and not to do, and I had him, and now I'm free. I don't know what to do. You see, if I'm not reacting about something, I don't know what to do, you know. And so I began to look for excitement. Guess what? I saw it across the street. The boy across the street, he'd go out and get drunk. He'd come home and beat up his wife. This was the kind of stuff my mother's family did. So I was very familiar with that. And I've always felt that it was okay for women to beat up men, but women should not be beat up by men. And I know it's a double standard, and I'm a female chauvinist piglet. What can I tell you? But that was how I saw that. And this little girl, I felt especially sorry for her. She was French-Canadian, didn't speak English very well. And so Joanne and I became friends, and so she was pregnant. And he came in one night and beat her up, and she came over to my house, and she came in. She wasn't looking too hot, and her lip was busted, and her eye was turning blue, and she said that she had gone into labor. Would I take her to the hospital? And I said, sure. And so we went back over to her house to pack her little bag to go to the hospital, and he was passed out on his bed with a little smirk on his face. And I looked at him, and I thought, you know, somebody ought to whip his butt. And then it was my first spiritual awakening. I said, I'm somebody. So I tied him up in his bed sheet. I took a slat out of the bed, and I beat the fool out of him. Whew, made me feel good all over. Little did I know that was the preview of coming attractions, you know. So the next day he came over to my house, and he came in to knock on the door, and he said, you know where my wife is? I said, yes, yeah, she's in the hospital. You had a baby last night. He said, well, I was in a real bad fight last night. I guess you lost. Lived on the other side of me. There's another alcoholic. You know, did you ever feel like you were a carrier? Because everywhere you go, there they are. This guy, the doctor told him, he said, Freeman, you're an alcoholic. If you continue to drink, you will die. And so Freeman quit drinking. He never went to Alcoholics Anonymous. So now we got to see what irritable, restless, and discontent was about over there. Well, now, see, I'm a fun person. I'm a night person. I've never been a day person. And so I would get home about 7:30 in the morning and be ready to go to bed. Well, he went to till his garden. Can you believe that? At that hour of the morning, you know. Of course, I realized today that was before the heat of the day. He was wanting to get that done. But you see, it's all about me. It doesn't have anything to do with him and what he wants. And so I went out and I explained to him in no uncertain terms about him and the tiller and the noise. And he told me to shut my mouth and get my fat butt back in the house. He didn't know about Mama and the fish. I got my daddy's frog gig and headlight, and I mowed my grass at 11:30 at night. How do you like that? The sheriff came to see me. So you go into plan B. Now, Freeman had 6 beagles. Now, if you've ever had one little beagle dog, you know what a barky, barky, yappy, yappy little dog. Well, he has a whole chorus out there. He's got 6 of them. And so I would wait till the wee hours of the morning. I'd run off my back porch. I'd grab a broom handle. I'd go out there. I'd run up and down his dog yard fence, stir them dogs into a complete hysterical frenzy. I'd run, jump back on my porch and wait. And they'd be out there just, and he'd run out in his underwear. He'd be cussing at them, screaming at them, hose them down, go back in the house. We'd wait about an hour, and one more time. And the sheriff came to see me. It occurred to me after several more episodes that the sheriff and I were developing a relationship, and this was not good news. So I began to look elsewhere for my entertainment, and that's when I realized we had a neighborhood softball team. And so, what can I say? I was always an athlete in school, so I got me some stretch boots, some hot pants, and joined the team. Went over there. Now, it was our custom after the game, you got to remember now, this is the middle 60s, and it was our custom after a game to go back over to somebody's house and discuss our strategy and what we could have, should have, what we're going to do next time. And during that, some of them were popping tops and others were sniffing some stuff. And then there was those funny little cigarettes and those sugar cubes, just your normal neighborhood back in those days. And we were just having fun, you know. Well, it was my turn. It was all over my house, and this kid got drunk at my house. And he was 18, but that's not legal to age to drink. And I began to think. Now, see, that's what always scares me with people I sponsor when they say, I've been thinking. You know, go, ooh. I'm thinking, you know, if he gets caught going home by the cops, he's going to come back, and the sheriff is going to be on me for contributing to the delinquency of a minor, and I'm going to be in trouble. So I'm going to drive this kid home, and they can follow and bring me back, and we'll take care of this. Well, I get out to his pickup, and sitting in the front seat is a China tea set. And I said, what is this? And he said, oh, it's for my mom. I'm going to give it to her for Mother's Day. And I said, well, don't cry about it. Don't cry about it. You know how some of them are when they drink too much. Ooh, don't cry. Don't cry. So I drove him home, and I'm thinking, you know, if he tries to carry that China tea set in, he's going to break it, so I better carry it in. So now here's the picture. It's in about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. I'm going to a strange house, never been there before in my life. I'm escorting a drunken 18-year-old kid, and I'm carrying a China tea set, your everyday situation. We get into his room. He flips the light on. There's a man laying there on the bed with nothing but his jockey shorts, and he looks up and goes, hot damn, little brother, you brought us a broad home. And I looked at him and I said, not tonight, fella. But that's who I'm married to. Yeah. I suppose you found yours in the front row of the choir? Later on that summer, I had a 3-day birthday party. And we met again. And he told his brother, he said, she's too weird for me. And I thought, how dare he? I mean, here I was, my hair was long and black, and I had a part in the mill store like Cher used to wear hers. And I had mowed grass and thrown it in the house, and I had it all around in the floor, and we had these cushions, and we painted the walls black, and we had nudes painted, and the black lights, and the rock music, and he thought I was weird. I mean, just having fun, for God's sake. But later on, we met again, and I offered him a drink, and all of a sudden I became less weird. And we started dating, and everything was wonderful for about 4 years. He ruined everything. He asked me to marry him. You see, there's a time you tell things. And if you go past the time to tell things, there doesn't seem to be a good time to tell. And you just hope it's never going to come up. You know, one of those kind of things. And I said, oh, I can't marry you. And he said, well, why not? Don't you love me? I said, it has absolutely nothing to do with anything. And he said, what do you mean? I said, well, I can't marry you. He said, well, why not? And I said, well, I'm already married. He said, are you sure? You sure didn't act married. I said, I forgot. Out of sight, out of mind. And he just looked at me. Now, to show you here, the insanity doesn't just work one way. He still wanted to marry somebody who couldn't remember they were married. That amazes me today when I think about that. But like I say, the sickness just fits so well in that sickness. And so I got divorced, and then alcoholism moved into my house, and I never saw it. I knew he didn't know how to drink right. And I knew that it going out with him on a date, with him drinking, was like going out with a whole bunch of guys at one time. There was the guy that came to pick you up who hadn't had anything to drink. It's sort of boring. And then there was the guy who had a couple of drinks. Fun, now we're going to have fun. But we just didn't stay there very long. And then there was a guy that had 6 or 8 drinks, and then he got thinking about every bad thing that ever happened to him in his life. And then the guy kept on drinking, and then he'd get a mouth on him like an old Chevy trunk, and I'd have to put him out of my misery. And and then, you know, this is where I realized, too, you know, alcoholism is an allergy, you know. It's part allergy. And that's true because, you know, he broke out in spots. Memphis, Dallas, New Orleans, St. Louis, you know, he would just get drinking and go, and you wouldn't see him for a week or two, you know. Now, that's unacceptable because what happens to the person who's left at home when you disappear? Are you alive? Are you dead? Who are you with? What are you doing? Are you okay? Are you not okay? You know, those kind of things. And then that not knowing, that becomes, and that's where the obsession to stop the drinking started. On those disappearances with that not knowing, is he alive? Is he dead? What's going on? And so the hell of alcoholism. Now the fun is gone, and now the hell of alcoholism begins. And it gets worse and it gets worse. It's a progressive disease. It's worse for the alcoholic. It's worse for the non-alcoholic. Alcoholism is a family disease. It affects the person who drinks it, and it's equally devastating to the person who doesn't drink it, who is watching it day by day take away someone they love. And they do everything within their power to fight the disease. But let me tell you, anytime you enter the ring with alcoholism, you're going to get your butt whipped. It doesn't make any difference on which side of that you fall. You cannot fight that disease. There's nothing. We're powerless over that disease of alcoholism. And so there was, like I said, there was a lot of violence in our home, but it was violence initiated by me, because by now I've become the mother of the bad boy, and he won't mind, and he won't do what I tell him to, so then he has to come home and pay the penalty. And when he'd get picked up for DWI, which was a lot, you know, he would have to tell the police all about themselves and about their family history. And so it would irritate them. But they learned early on, they don't have to do anything. They don't have to get charges of police brutality. They'll take him home. Don't call her, he'd say. Don't call her. She'll hurt me. And they'd say, we know. And he'd come home and pay the penalty. Well, you know, years go on like that, and now it's to the point where I'm the only one. You know, now here it is. I used that first husband for financial security, you know. And guess what? What goes around comes around, because now I have somebody living off of me. You know, those things have a tendency to what goes around comes around. And I'm working two jobs in order so that I can, you know, keep him happy. Because if I don't give him what he wants, then he'll go out and drink. And so you got to keep them happy, and you can't keep them happy enough, because sooner or later they're going to go out and drink again. And you know, I believe today that I could tie him up in the closet and put the handcuffs and stuff on him like Houdini, come back in 30 minutes, and that somebody would be drunk. They find a way. So it's alcoholic, cunning, baffling, powerful, you know. There's no way to keep them from it, but you go through the hell of trying and trying to outthink them the whole time. And guess what? It drives you crazy. And it got to the point where I said, you know, I'm through. I've had it. You've got to leave. And he said, well, you know, I don't mean to be doing what I'm doing. He said, I just want to stop and have a few drinks like everybody else, but something happens to me. He said, I think I'm sick. I said, well, that's the truth. You are sick, sick, sick. And he looked at me, you know, and the thing of it is, I broke his spirit with my mouth. The things that I said to him and told him how small he was and what a little pipsqueak he was and if he had any gumption at all and if you were half a man and all like that, not realizing I'm talking about a disease. But he's taking all of those things, and he already feels so bad about himself, and I am just heaping that onto him and onto him until I broke his spirit. Anyway, I told him, I said, well, if you're sick, I'll take you to our family doctor. And so I did. Now, for the first time, the doctor knows what's wrong with me. I've been in there with stomach problems. I've been in there with nerve problems, headaches, you name it. I'm high blood pressure now. Everything's going wrong in my physical state because I'm not dealing with my problems. And but he told him that he thought he might have a slight drinking problem. And I looked and I said, that's like the Titanic had a bad day. And the doctor says, well, you know, I don't know what to tell you to do, J.D. He said, Alcoholics Anonymous seems to do more for drunks than what the medical profession knows about. And he said, I would suggest that you try some meetings at Alcoholics Anonymous. And J.D. looked at him stunned, and he said, I'm not an alcoholic. I drink too much. I get drunk. But I'm not an alcoholic. And the doctor looked at me, and I said, that's right. He's not. He wasn't like my mama's people. And see, that's what I had used as the gauge of what an alcoholic was my mama's people. And J.D. didn't act like they did. I acted like they did, not him. And so, anyway, we left there, though, but J.D. had some friends who were taking antabus, and he asked the doctor for a prescription. So we left, and I have the prescription. I can't trust him. I will be the keeper of the pill. So now, every morning getting ready to go to work, I've got high blood pressure, I've got a dog that's epileptic, and J.D.'s on the pill. In a hurry, I can't guarantee who gets what, but everybody gets a pill. Okay, what have I said for years? If he'll quit drinking, I'll be okay. That's like, I have a headache. Would you please take my aspirin? Yeah, makes just as much sense to me today. But you see, I expected everything to be different, and there wasn't any, it was worse now. Because he's not drinking, he's getting no help for his alcoholism, I'm not getting any help for me. It just didn't work right, and so I'm sitting there and I got to thinking. You know, we couldn't even decide on a meal without a major knockdown dragout. You know, what do you want for supper? Anything. You want some fried chicken? No, I don't want fried chicken. Well, what do you want? Anything. Would you like some spaghetti? No. In fact, you make the world's worst spaghetti. Thank you for sharing. What do you want? I don't care. Anything. So I'd fix anything, and he'd look at me, and he'd say, you don't expect me to eat this, do you? And I'd say, well, you have a choice. You can eat it, or you can wear it. Sometimes he ate it. Sometimes he wore it. I mean, we were fighting every day now, and there's no alcohol involved. You see, a lot of people think alcohol has a lot to do with alcoholism, you know. And believe me, it never becomes wasm. It's always alcoholism. It doesn't go away. The ism is always there, lurking. But anyway, I got to thinking, maybe it wasn't the alcohol. Maybe he's the problem. Well, why don't you get a divorce? Well, that sounds good. No, we can't get a divorce. What do you mean I can't get a divorce? Well, you've already divorced one. If you have to keep divorcing them, where's the common denominator? We're not going there. But, you know, if he were to die, you could be a widow, and that would be what? Well, that's honorable, being a widow, not being a divorcee over and over. Oh, but he's not dying. We can take care of that. Oh. Well, what do you want to do? Well, frankly, I want to take an ice pick, stab him in the neck, and watch him drip. Ooh, it just makes you feel good all over, you know. Or, I tell you what, we could get, you know, roll over him with the car, you know, back over him. Make a note, buy new tires. I want lots of tread to squish him up in. And I begin to feel better. It was light at the end of the tunnel for me. And so you're waiting, and then all of a sudden one day I'm reading in the paper where a woman killed her husband and said he was an alcoholic, and they put her butt in prison. And I thought, how could they do that? Wouldn't happen if I'd have been on that jury. Tacky. How could they do that? So now I've got to have another meeting. You know, so I call that fall, I call all the Mary Pearls together, and we got thinking again. And all of a sudden, you know, it just came one night, you know, if an alcoholic were to pass out in the bathtub and drown, who would know? Who would know? We all liked it. It was a group conscience. And so now you just wait because, you know, sooner or later he's going to drink again. He always does. And guess what? A year to the week he went on antabuse. Guess what happened? He fell drunk. And when he came home that day, we had ice and snow, and that's about like probably when y'all get ice and snow, the whole world shuts down because nobody knows how to drive on it. And I had come home from work, and I was waiting, and then I heard our truck, because you know the sound of your vehicle, because God knows you listen for it enough. You know, you'd know it anywhere. And I hear it, and he's in the truck, and he's in second gear. It sounds like he's doing about 50 going down the street. And that second gear whine. And then he comes across and he hits the hitching post horse at the end of the driveway, which was cast iron and concrete. Thup! Knocked it over. He went sailing sideways across the yard. He hit the tree and then bounced into the side of the house. Wow, he cannot drive on this. And I'm looking out my picture window. And all of a sudden he opened that truck door, but he poured out. I'd seen that so many times and I thought, I'll kill that SOB if it's the last thing I ever do. And so when he opened the front door, I never said a word to him at all. I just hit him. I hit him as hard as I could, and when I did, he fell, and he hit the coffee table and knocked him out. And I dragged him across our living room floor, across the hall, into the bathroom. I run that bathtub full of warm water. I took his clothes off of him, and I put him in, and I held him under. I held him under until the bubbles quit coming because I wanted him dead. He was the problem. And then another voice, which was not a committee member, said, look what you're doing. You can't do this. And I reached down, and I got him by the hair of the head, and I pulled him up, and I said, the hell I can't. And I put him back down. And he's laying there in the bottom of the tub, and the voice says, don't you realize you're committing murder? You're taking the life of someone you once loved. And it's like a moment of clarity when all of a sudden you realize, holy God, if you'd have told me I was capable of killing another human being, I would have told you you're crazy. Yeah, I'm mean and I'm ornery and all like that, but I couldn't take the life of someone, and yet here it was. Thank God I had worked for the Red Cross. See, God always goes ahead and plans in love. He knew I was going to need to know how to resuscitate. I jerked J.D. up out of that bathtub, and I was able to resuscitate him by the grace of God. And I drug him into the bedroom. I dried him off, and I put him up in the bed. I even got the hair dryer down and dried his hair because I didn't want him to catch cold. Want him dead, but not with a cold. Now, you men may not understand that, but the women do. Men with a cold are worse to deal with. Whiny. No. And then I left, and I shut the door on that bedroom, and I went in the living room, and I began to rock in that big rocker recliner, hours and hours. And I knew I could not live like that another day, but I didn't know how not to live like that another day. There was a desperation I had never known in my life, and I just sort of closed off. And I went on, and I went to work the next day as if nothing had happened, because, you see, my best friends were justification and rationalization. You know, and I just knew that if he hadn't have got drunk, I wouldn't have had to do that. It's not my fault. You know, they'll tell you that that's where you give yourself an acceptable reason for unacceptable behavior. But there used to be a lady in AA, and I loved Holly's definition better. And Holly used to say, justification and rationalization are just like masturbation. You're only screwing yourself. And that's the truth. That's the truth. I came home from work one day, and J.D. had come out of the room. He was in there for 3 days. I heard him beg and yell for help and what have you, and I had seen him hallucinate many times, so I didn't pay any attention. J.D. had alcoholic poisoning. He liked to hemorrhage to death in that room. So it's only by the grace of God that J.D.'s still alive today, and I am not in prison somewhere, because I've been to prison, and there's people in prison that are doing time for less than things that I've done. You know, who knows? But anyway, he said, would you call that number, Alcoholics Anonymous, for me? I've been trying all day long, and I'm shaking so hard with that push-button phone. He just wasn't getting anywhere. And so I called the central office of Alcoholics Anonymous, and there was a lady there, and she told me there was a meeting in 1 hour's time, 6 blocks away from our home in a community building that was built by my grandfather who died of the disease of alcoholism. And that was where Alcoholics Anonymous was meeting. I went to that building to scout meetings when I was a kid growing up. And so I took J.D. over for his first meeting, and I was in such great shape that night, they thought I was the alcoholic, and they welcomed me in and told J.D. there was Al-Anon over there for him. Got that straightened out. And I am so grateful for old-fashioned AA, because there was a man there that had worked for the railroad, and he was an old bachelor, and he just took one look at J.D., and he walked over to him, and he said, boy, I'm going to be your sponsor. And that old man saved J.D.'s life. If he had gone to a meeting where they say, just keep coming back, and when you find somebody you can relate to, well, then you can get a sponsor, you know, J.D. would have died. J.D. would have died. And so, anyway, J.D. started to get better. Now, there's nothing worse than somebody getting better, and it's not you. Because, you see, when the Al-Anons told me that Al-Anon was for me, I told them there's nothing wrong with me. He's the one with the problem. Now, this is the lady that just tried to commit murder. There's nothing wrong with me. I had a very good denial system. And so J.D. began to get better, and he and the old guy would go to all these meetings. Then one night, every time they'd go to a meeting, though, J.D. would bring me back literature from the Al-Anon women. They knew something was going on. They would send pamphlets by way of him home to me. I wouldn't read that trash. But for some reason, I didn't throw it away. I just put it in a desk. And then there was one night when he and the old man didn't come back, and I knew this, both out drunk. And as it turned out, they were on a 12-step call. But who knew about that? And I got into there, and there was a little 3x4, you know, just a little business card in there. And it said, "My name's Earlene, if you ever want to talk." It's 11 o'clock at night. I want to talk, Earlene. And so I called, and she was very, very nice, and she told me about Al-Anon. I said, "Oh, well, okay, if I ever need that, I'll come." And J.D., now, he worked 1 or 2 days a week drunk. And they would say with the 2 days that J.D. would work, he would do as much work as somebody who worked a whole work week, because you know how you overcompensate? And so they kept him on the job for 10 years, drinking on a daily basis. And he got sober, and guess what? He couldn't work. He was shaking so bad he could not work. J.D.'s a welder. When you're shaking, a welder doesn't do too hot. He says you can't hold a bead, you know. But anyway, so now J.D. got fired from his job. And so it's like, what are you going to do? Now, the things that meant the most in my life were my possessions, and now they're threatened. So now I go to Al-Anon. You see, everybody has what it takes to get there. It's not what gets you there. It's why you stay there. You know, because a lot of people come for a lot of different reasons. But if you don't stay there for you, then it's not going to work, you know. But anyway, I went over there and I told them that I wanted to know, A, how you keep an alcoholic sober, and B, how you manage when there's nothing left to manage. And there was a smart aleck there. She said, "C, we don't know." Oh, that was a bummer, you know. But I kept going back, and at one point, and I looked back, and I said, why did I keep going back to those meetings? They said 2 words that night that meant more than anything I had heard in years. We understand. We understand as no one else can. There's no one there that's going to tell you it's bad to love an alcoholic. There's no one that's going to tell you there that you have to divorce them. There's nobody that's going to tell you you have to stay. There's nobody going to do all those things. But they know, and they've been there, and then they did what they do best. They began to share their experience, strength, and hope with me, the newcomer. And I know today it was the unconditional love that I received, because I was not a lovable person. I know you find that hard to believe. And, you know, when I came in, these were old ladies that were there in Al-Anon. You know, they were these little white-haired, thin-lipped, cookie-baking bitches, for God's sake. And I could not believe any one of them had ever done the stuff that I had done. Because, you know, they'd been married 40, 50 years to these old guys. You know, I'm thinking, gee, you know. And I've got a lot of issues here, you know. And then one night there was this old lady, and her name was Louise, and she was in her 70s. And she was talking about her husband, and they lived in an apartment house. And how she would stretch a string across the top of the steps and hope he'd fall down the stairs and break his neck. And I thought, I love her. Did you know it's when we share those dark corners of our life that we give the other people permission to let go of those secrets that keep us so sick? And so the healing process can begin. That is so necessary. So necessary. And so I began to go to those meetings, and guess what? I began to get better, and I got a sponsor. And then my life changed when I started the steps. Because you can go to meetings, 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 meetings. I went to meetings every night. I was either in an Al-Anon meeting or an open AA meeting for years. I never missed a meeting. And you can sit in those meetings, but if you can't take what you're getting out of those meetings and put it to work in your life, which you won't be able to do if you don't have a sponsor in the steps, then it's not going to be, it won't make you any more different than sitting in the garage is going to make you a car. You're going to have to take action, because action's the key. And so I began to take the actions that I was told to take. And guess what? I took my focus off of him. Boy, did I. When I did, I mean, I let go with a vengeance. And it's like I had a really hard time just even talking to him about anything. It would be like, okay, I'm going to go to the movie tomorrow night. If you want to go, you can go with me. But I don't care if you go with me or not, because I'm going to go whether you go or not. Now, what do you think about that? But before, if he said he was going with me to the movie and he didn't go, then I didn't go and I felt bad. And I hated him for not going. So see, this was progress. But it, you know, it's like our pendulum goes swing, swing. It doesn't go swing, swing. You know, it just doesn't do that. It takes a while for balance to arrive, you know. And he would go, well, I don't even know if I want to go to there or not. I don't care. And so we would go to the meetings, and after about 6 months, we became Mr. AA and Ms. Al-Anon. We would cuss each other all the way to the meeting, get out and... Isn't this a wonderful program? We'd get back in the car, cuss each other all the way home. So phony. But we were trying. We were trying, you know. When I look back at it today, it's like, oh, God, help us all. You know, it was so trying. But, you know, if you just keep doing the things you're supposed to be doing, and I kept taking the action I didn't want to take in order to get the result I did want. And I kept doing all those stupid things my sponsor said that I knew wouldn't work, and I only did them to prove to her they wouldn't work. And guess what? They work. They work. And so my life changed. And as our life changed, our relationship changed. And then all of a sudden, we began to have the kind of relationship and the kind of marriage that I'd always wanted us to have. But now, I got that mother sitting over there. You know, that damaged relationship from as far back as I can remember. And it's like, how am I ever going to get that reconciled with her? She's old. God, she's old. She's getting close to 80 now. And it was like, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? And my sponsor said, well, when you become ready, God will put the teachers in the path. And a girl came to our group who had worked through a lot of mother stuff. And she said, first thing you're going to have to do is give your mother a break and accept the fact that she wasn't perfect, but there's no perfect children either. You know? And she said, you're going to have to accept that she is the way she is and quit trying to change her. She says, don't try to change her. Accept her just the way she is, like we did you when you came. We accepted you and loved you just the way you were. And I said, I don't know. That's a big order. I don't know if I can do that. She said, well, it's going to take that. So that night going home from the meeting, I was squalling my guts out because, you know, a dream dies hard because you have the idea of what you want your relationship with your mom to be, how you want her to be. You want her to be kind and loving and tell you how sweet and wonderful you are and how much you've always meant to her. And, you know, and that's quite a burden to put on somebody. And so as I'm crossing the river from Little Rock into North Little Rock where I live, it was like I said, okay, God, I'm tired of the fight. I'm going to ask you to be my mama now. I'm going to ask you to give me all of that stuff that I always wanted from her and she couldn't give me. I'm going to ask you to give it to me and give it to me in a way and I can understand. And you know what it was? My older sister had been my mama all my life and I never gave her credit for it. She did all of those kind, loving, nurturing things that I wanted from my mama. And now I couldn't see them because I was looking at mama for them. And you're looking in the wrong direction. You miss that stuff. But it had been there all along for me. And I was so blind looking to mama to give me something she couldn't give me when Dorothy was doing it all along. And so I was given another tool, and this has been one of the best tools I've ever been given in the 12-step program. Ask God to let you see, and it was mother, as he sees her. Ask God to let you see that person that you're having those problems with as he sees her. Because God is love and God only looks through love. Love is kind. Love is all of those things. And I said, I don't know if I'll ever. And so I prayed that prayer for a long time. And I said to my sponsor, I said, I prayed this prayer about 4 or 5 years now. How long do I have to pray this damn prayer? And she said, oh, just till it works. I said, oh. But I didn't realize. See, I kept waiting on God changing mama. God didn't change mama. God changed me. And then one year, in the fall of the year, I'm driving over to my mama's, and I pull in the driveway, and I see her. She's way out in the back. We got 10 acres, and she loves to have her yard looking like a park. And she's out there raking, and all of a sudden, I recognize something I've never seen before. My mother's short. And I go, God, how did you miss that? You know, it's like, you know, I mean, she comes up to hear on me. How come you wouldn't know your mother's short? Because you always come as a child. And when you're a child, mama's big. You know? And I looked at that and I said, oh my God, I'm coming as a child. And it was like, you know, did you ever come over here not wanting some? See, I always wanted my mama to approve of me. I wanted mama to accept me. I wanted mama to love me. And so I went over there, give me, give me, give me. When did you ever come over here giving what you want? When did you come giving unconditional love to your mama? Oh, my God. It's like God said to me, Mary Pearl, life is a potluck. What are you bringing? Bring what you want to have. And so as I'm walking back up there to my mother, it's like I saw inside her heart. And where I thought my mother held all that love and withheld it to punish me, I didn't see that love. I saw scars all in my mother's heart. And I knew that if we were going to have love in that relationship, I was going to have to bring it. And I could, because I had been taught how to love in rooms like these by people like y'all. Y'all had given me that gift. And so I went up there and I asked my mama to put down the leaf broom, and I gave my mama a hug. First hug ever. And my mama was stiff as a poker, I'm telling you. Because we don't do stuff like that. We don't talk. We don't touch. We don't do anything. And you know, but I made a point from that point on to consistently, when I was around my mother, to give her a hug, to pat her, to be kind to her. And then one day I could say, "Love you, Mom." And she'd just look at me. And I would go on. And it didn't matter if you got it back. I was doing what I needed to do. And then one day I was over at my mama's and she said, "You know, Mary Pearl, I always wondered why after your daddy died you became such a rotten, ornery kid." And I said, "Well, Mama, I'll tell you, I was getting even with you for not loving me." She said, "What do you mean I didn't love you?" I said, "Well, Mama, you never told me you loved me. You never found anything but fault no matter what I did." I said, "You didn't even go to my graduation. I was a valedictorian in my class and you weren't even there. You didn't." "I had to work," she said. I said, "Okay." And she says, "But how could you say I didn't love you? Didn't I give you a roof over your head? Didn't I give you food to eat? Didn't I give you clothes to wear?" It was more than I had. You see, my mother had been raised in that abusive alcohol home where her mother and father both drank. And her daddy was a mean drunk, and he would come in, and Mama had scars all over her body where he'd cut her up with a knife when he'd come home drunk. And when she was 13, and he came home one night drunk, he tried to rape her. And she hit him in the head with a stick of stove wood, and she ran away from home, and she walked from Gleason, Tennessee to Memphis, and she lived in an alleyway in a box in the early 1900s. Wasn't popular to be a runaway back then. And the lady on that alleyway, there was a boarding house, and the lady who ran it was pregnant, and she told my mom she would give her room and board if she'd come help her in the boarding house and got her out of that alley. My daddy was the head of the recruiting office for the Army in Memphis. He was much older than my mother. And he took his meals in that boarding house, and he met my mama there. And when she turned 16, they got married in the parlor of that boarding house. Now, if you'd had to live your life that way, what would be the greatest gift you could ever give a child? Food to eat, clothes to wear, and a place to stay, something she never had. And the safety, you know. She never had those things. And you know something? That day, it became enough for this child. And I told her, I said, "Mama, what can I do to make it up to you for all the hurt that I've done to you over the years so many times on purpose? What can I do to make that up to you today?" And she said, "Forgive me for not being the kind of mama you needed." And I said, "Mama, I forgive you." And my mama got up and she walked across the room and she gave me the hug and she kissed me on the cheek and she said, "Baby, I love you. I've always loved you." And to the best of her ability, she had. And I knew it, and it became, and you know, that hole inside me that I'd had for a lifetime went away because I did what you told me to do. And the relationship, like I say, with my sister has always been great. But we had our problems. Like I say, Mama went ahead and she had a series of strokes and she passed away. And then in 1995, Dorothy began to have health problems and she had to have a triple bypass surgery. And then 45 years to the day that I watched Daddy die, I watched my sister die in the front seat of my car in bumper-to-bumper traffic. And there was a cop coming, and I got his attention, and there was a new hospital just open, and so we got her over there, and she was blue, and they took her in, and they revived her, and she was in a coma for 28 days, but Dorothy did not come back. Now, there's a person there. She lives, but Dorothy lost 40 years of her memory, and she has no short-term memory. I can go into her room and visit her in 15 minutes, go down the hall, come back, and I'm there for the first time. She can't remember anything. She doesn't have a save button on her memory, you know, nothing saves. And, you know, that's been a very difficult 9 years to be going through. And this year, Dorothy's had a lot of health issues. She's had a cancer removed. She fell and broke her hip and had to have a hip replacement. And every time she goes under anesthetic, we lose more Dorothy, you know. It's called anoxic brain injury when you lose the oxygen to your brain. But you know, Dorothy has taught me how to live in the moment. Because that's where she is. She's in the moment. And, you know, she'd say to me, I wish I could remember. And I thought, you know, I can remember. I'll remember for both of us. And so when I go to visit my sister, I go and I share with her a fun thing that we've done together. And for that moment in time, she gets so excited and she just loves it. And then in 10 minutes, it's gone. But that's okay, you know, because that helps me, you know. And we know it's all about me, don't we? But, you know, I we don't know when these things happen, what's going to happen. But, you know, right after Dorothy crashed and burned on me, I had to go to the doctor, and I found out that I had a heart condition. And I said, who knows the progression of events, the way they happen. Sometimes I went through a terrible period of depression through the year of 2000, and it was just really hard. And I was going to meetings nearly every day. I was talking to a sponsor. And, you know, I wasn't getting any better. And I kept saying, but what do we do? You just keep on coming back. You keep on coming back. And then the thing will pass. All things come to pass. The good times will pass, and you will have bad times. But this is a program for living that works under all conditions. And you just keep. And the main thing was, I had y'all, and I never had to do it alone. Never had to do it alone. Just like I'm not doing this walk alone with Dorothy right now. Because God is there. And JD and I have grown so much closer during these hard times. We could not believe the closeness. You know, one day JD always said, you're the strong one. And I was like, no, no. And I thought, yeah, I am. Weenie man, you know. I mean, I'm up in the CNN tower with him and a guy sponsor, and they have a glass floor up there. You know, it's the tallest freestanding structure, and I'm dancing around with the little kids on the glass floor, and they're going, how can you do that? And I said, well, it's, and they go, oh, no, I know, and I go, weenie man. But there I am one night, and I'm in my kitchen, I'm standing in front of the sink, and I'm putting the dishes in the dishwasher, and all of a sudden life just became too much. And I just collapsed in the floor. And I thought I would never stop crying. I was just apart. And JD got down in the floor, and he sat down, and he held me in his arms, and he rocked me. And he said, honey, this is going to be okay. I said, I don't think it's ever going to be okay. I just don't feel it's ever going to be okay. He said, isn't it great feelings aren't facts? And I said, I don't want to hear that shit. I'm suffering. Leave me alone. I'm suffering. And I said, where is God in all this? And he said, I don't know. But he said, I know that my God is greater than all of this. And if you've lost yours for right now, lean on mine until you find yours again. And that's what I did. So, you know, things are going to happen. But over and over, one more time, God is there. And God is the answer. My life is busy the weaving between my God and me. I do not choose the colors, but he worketh steadily. Oft times in sorrow, sometimes foolish pride, I forget he sees the top and not the underside. Not till the loom is silent and the shuttle cease to fly, will God unroll the canvas and explain the reasons why. But the dark threads are as needful in a skillful weaver's hand as the threads of gold and silver in the pattern God has planned. Thank you for having me.